Welcome to the Evolution Eats podcast. My name's Noah.
And I'm Emily. And today we have Nick Katsumpis, who I met at Tufts back in undergrad. We were in a healthy lifestyle club called Balance Your Life Together. And he was president, and he's always been really passionate about health and wellness. And he's doing this really cool thing right now. He is a plant coach, which is, you know, a unique concept in general. So we're just going to talk to him a little bit about what he does. He makes a living full-time as a plant coach in New York City. So welcome. Thanks so much for being here.
No, thank you so much for having me. It feels like just yesterday that we were sitting in Medford and having our BYL meeting. So I'm excited we were able to reconnect. It's going to be fun.
Yeah, it's great.
So Nick, can you tell us a little about how all of this got started? People that don't know what you do, sort of let's get the background going here.
Yeah, so I would describe what I do, which is, I know, rather unconventional, but I consider myself a plant coach and apartment farmer.
Okay.
And what I mean by that is it's sort of my mission to give people the knowledge and competence they need to sustainably create their own green spaces. And this started for me actually right after I graduated from Tufts, because back in 2014, I was just finishing up my collegiate baseball career. I was a personal trainer. And so right. The food that I was eating was really important to me. You know, it was about performance. It was about health. It was about making sure my body was sustained. And from that, I had this job at IBM that was starting in this, you know, later in the fall. And my mom said, you know, why don't you do something around the house? Why don't you start a garden? You love food. Why don't you start a garden? I was like, you know what? Why don't I do that? I've got a couple months to kill. Let's see how it goes. And I just became obsessed. Like, I was growing just basic stuff at first, just tomatoes, cucumbers, squash. And then once I got my hands dirty and started tasting this amazing, delicious food, which tastes 10 times better than anything I'd get in the grocery store, which we'll talk about later.
Mm-hmm.
But I just felt so connected to the land and felt so good about what I was doing. So each year just got bigger and bigger, and the garden got more robust. And, you know, then the chipmunks started eating it. So I built this even bigger thing. And then it just became something where now I'm growing like 10 different types of heirloom tomatoes, experimental varieties of squash and corn, and like all these different variety of things that I never would have grown before. And it was just so fulfilling to me. I still manage that for my parents. Kind of like my mom's own personal CSA share, right?
So that's at her house?
To the city.
Yeah,
exactly, yeah. Right? You know, I tend to it. She gets literally the fruits of my labor.
Yeah.
But after moving to New York City last, you know, almost 4 years now, I kind of went into green withdrawal and shock. And it was something that was kind of new for me, because I was like, okay, like I've been around nature my whole life. I've been around the earth and the dirt, and now I'm in this concrete box, and how am I supposed to be happy this way? And I said, okay, you know, I've got a green thumb for growing crops and vegetables and fruits. Why can't I just apply the same thing to houseplants? And they're totally different, right? Like it's a different science, and a lot of the farmers that I meet are totally clueless about houseplants, and the houseplant people are totally clueless about agriculture. So I was trying to bridge the gap.
Oh, that's interesting.
And I started just learning on my own, trial and error, research, reading books, reading blogs, and 65-ish houseplants later, which is not that many compared to many of my houseplant contemporaries. But, you know, I had built this kind of urban jungle for myself, and I felt great, and it felt so good, and especially in winter in New York, which is tough. I mean, we don't have the beautiful weather like you have all year long. So it was a nice way for me to connect. And my girlfriend, she had suggested, she goes, you know what, like, you know a lot about this. Why don't you post it on Instagram? I was like, oh, no. Guys don't do that. Not into it. Don't care. She goes, seriously, people might actually benefit from learning that you did this. Because it's not like I'm a botany PhD. You know, I'm just a normal guy who figured this out. And you could too. So I started the Instagram, and like literally it snowballed to the point, you know, I've only been doing Instagram really officially for like 2 years on this. And, you know, the Farmer Nick NYC account was born. And people started asking me questions from around the country, around the world. People were asking me for advice about this, this, and that. And I learned so much from those interactions. And then all of a sudden someone said, hey, could you help me do this at my apartment or my office or my cafe? And that's how the clientele started coming in. So that is the origin story of how Farmer Nick officially germinated.
Oh.
Wow.
Oh my
love
God.
The pun.
Sorry for the plant puns. There's going to be lots of them.
I hope so. All the better.
I love how you give credit to your mom and your girlfriend. That's very sweet of you.
Hey, two powerful, strong women in my life who had really good ideas.
This is, I mean, I think still a pretty unconventional path to a career, a new thing that people could be interested in. And it's sort of a response to this crazy urbanization that's happening. And you said you gained this experience out in a more rural setting, and that makes a lot of sense to me personally. And then what I think people are quickly realizing is that a cityscape is not maybe what a human is always designed to live in, and it's detached us from something out in nature, mm-hmm. right? So do you find that clients are focused on that, or are they coming to you for some other reason? What are they actually interested in? What's the first thing they say, okay, I suffer from X, maybe this will help?
It's a fantastic question, and every client is different, but I couldn't agree more with your assessment because, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with the concept of biophilia, but it literally translates to love of life. And it's the theory that we as humans are inherently drawn to nature and want to be around nature. And it makes sense. I mean, we've been developing as humans and evolving for 5 to 7 million years in nature. And then only in the last couple thousand have we resigned ourselves to living this concrete, urbanized life, and we're not responding well to it.
Right.
So a lot of folks in New York City, although they think what they want is the aesthetic, what they're actually looking for is the connection. And it's my goal to try and introduce that to them in the easiest way possible. And a lot of folks, to be honest, they've had bad experiences. Right? You know, they go out, they buy a plant, they get excited, they bring it home, and then it's dead within 2 months. They say, I can't do this.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of what I do is it's not just about the knowledge, but it's like, I'm going to give you the confidence that you can do this, and here's how I'm going to show you the way. And for me, you know, it might start with aesthetics and making things look good, but by the end of it, you know, I'm taking clients plant shopping and they're naming their plants. They're like talking to them. One client, I kid you not, she started smelling the soil in the Uber ride home.
Wow.
And I'm like, are you okay? Like, what's going on? She goes, I haven't touched soil in a year. And that's shocking to me, right? Because I'm around soil all day. There's soil on my floor every day. But for her, if you're not living within close proximity to a park in New York, you might not interact with more than 10, 20 trees on the block in a given week. You know what I mean? So it's I mean, California is a different story, right?
Like,
you've got so much access, but in some of these areas, it's really difficult. And I love seeing the clients and the people that I work with start to recognize the benefits outside of just looking good.
Yeah, I mean, if I can defend them, I think they just don't realize what they think is looking good is really an overall life improvement. It's that internal connection, the biophilia.
Yeah.
They're just not naming that correctly. They know that they think that they feel better in a park or out in nature or climbing a mountain, and they want to experience that, and they think, oh, it's just about how it looks, but they're missing the actual goodness and the actual benefit that's happening there.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think that's interesting. I think that probably is happening with the food movement too. And we can get into that later, of course, but people are excited by good-looking food probably because it reminds their bodies of good-feeling food. And I would hope that that's something people can get more connected with as well. So do you help people plant edible food, or is it mostly aesthetic and oxygenating and proper indoor plants? Are you making little farms inside?
So most people start out saying, hey, I want the plant I saw on Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
It's purely aesthetic, right? Yes, there's some that, you know, detoxify the air, and obviously the oxygen benefits are fine,
right.
But they're trace amounts. It's not anything
of
significant.
Course.
What I will always encourage, especially if they've got a nice bright southern exposure, it's like, hey, like, you ever thought about some leafy greens on the windowsill?
Mm-hmm.
Or the easiest thing to get them with is basil or something like that. And they're like, oh, you know, I didn't think about that. How easy is that to do? And I was like, literally put the seed in the ground and just let it go, right? Mm-hmm. And when people see how simple some of these solutions can be, and granted, like, if you're trying to do this at an industrial vertical farm level, like, mm-hmm. the science behind it is incredible, mm-hmm. right? But for someone who just wants to every now and then say, oh, you know, I'm having a dinner party and here's some fresh basil on my window. So like, that's great. Mm-hmm. And the crowd pleaser, it makes you feel good. Like, it tastes great. And I think it's way easier than people think. So I always try and encourage them to incorporate something edible into their new ecosystem.
That's great. And obviously, I mean, I think most people can't start a whole farm in their apartments, but the more the merrier. And it certainly is relevant in one way to get them tasting food that actually they produce, which most people never get to experience, sadly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you mentioned, I mean, I was about to mention it for you, but you mentioned vertical farming. That's certainly started up in most major American cities in small capacity. It's obviously sort of a very futuristic technology. Do you think that has really any place in the future of farming in general, the future of feeding growing urban populaces? Or is that sort of just a dystopian attempted solution?
You know, it's a great question to think about in terms of, you know, the long-term success of it to feeding a population versus mm-hmm. being something that only certain folks can mm-hmm. afford. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, Emily and I used to talk about it in our meetings that, you know, nutrition and fitness should be a right, not a privilege. Mm-hmm. And at this stage in the game, given where the technology is now, given who has access to the vertical farming produce, right now it's a luxury, right? You know, to be able to say, hey, I'm getting, you know, my basil or my leafy greens or sometimes even tomatoes grown just, you know, 5 miles away instead of shipping them, I think the average food mile is 1,500 miles, especially here in New York. Like, it's brutal, right? So
yeah,
you feel good about the environment. You feel good about what you're eating because it's fresh and it was picked when it was ripe as opposed to being shipped on trucks and ripening en route to where you're going. Mm-hmm. So I think it definitely has a place. I think the biggest thing for me is how you can scale it. And if it can be scaled to the point where I can buy the lettuce that costs the same as the lettuce that was grown in a factory farm somewhere else, like, now I'm guaranteed food safety, I'm guaranteed quality, I'm guaranteed flavor. Like, half the people I know probably don't know what a real tomato should taste mm-hmm. like. But I think we're a long way from that. There are certainly companies that are doing some fantastic work. Aero Farms is fantastic. Gotham Greens, which is greenhouse-based versus vertical farms. And then we've also got a really unique one in the city called Farm One, which grows rare herbs and edible flowers for Michelin star chefs. And cool. It's amazing. Like, you guys would love, you totally should come next time you're in New York. I'll give you a tour.
Amazing.
Like, that is like the extreme of extreme. And I think there's definitely advances to make it more mainstream and accessible to everyone. And there's some really cool nonprofits, one in particular I do some work with called Teams for Food Justice, which is literally bringing hydroponic farms into the high school environment in the Bronx.
Oh, awesome.
So these kids who may have never seen this produce where their parents are food shopping, and now they're running a hydroponic farm and telling me about how they're growing cucumbers and these leafy greens, and this will go down to the cafeteria, and this will go to the farmer's market. Like, it is unbelievable and so inspiring. So I think the future is there, but we'll always need to have the normal traditional agriculture. I just hope we do it in a more regenerative fashion.
Absolutely. I mean, that's something that, of course, we talk about on this podcast all the time, but it's curious to see where people are struggling the most to access food and what their solutions end up being. I think you push them into a corner and companies and individuals find very unique solutions to these sorts of problems. But we tend to agree. I think the question was a bit leading, but it's interesting to see what people can come up with. It just may not be possible to transform every building into a green building, into a vertical farm. Green buildings, that would be a good idea.
Yeah, but like in the meantime, right, what you're doing is more accessible to more people than hydroponic farming. So it's right. Like a great way to make it accessible to more people.
And that could be true. So who do you think is the if you have any sense of this, who do you think is the average client that's coming to you? What's their sort of background?
So the average client for me mm-hmm. is probably going to be 30-year-old couple. They just moved in together, or they've been living together for a while, and they just got a new space, and they want it to feel like home. And this is interesting to me because I kind of see plants as not only a stepping stone towards sustainability, but also a stepping stone towards real parenthood, mm-hmm. right? And this is the plants, pets, and then children. And I think they kind of have an idealized view of it sometimes, where they're thinking it's going to be super easy. And granted, it's going to be easier than a pet and a child. But when your child or your dog is hungry, they're going to cry and they're going to bark. Mm-hmm. Plants are going to silently die and you won't know what's wrong, right? And a big theme of mine is teaching them that a lot of plant care is about loving the plants less. And what I mean by that is, you know, we tend to, especially in our society today, you know, helicopter parents, like you could be a helicopter plant parent where you are overly concerned. Anytime there's an imperfection, you're trying to manipulate something to get it fixed. But I think the biggest key is realizing, like, hey, like nature's been around a lot longer than we have. And it's going to figure it out. And there's going to be patches where it may not look perfect. There's going to be times where, especially with the seasons here in New York, you're going to go through stages and life cycles of the plant. And that's normal. This is nature, it's not furniture. And once you get them to understand some of those components, they start to really come into their own and feel really confident about the life that they've now brought into their own environment.
That's a huge, huge factor, I think. And it's good to hear that those are the kinds of people that are thinking about doing this, because if they can engender any sort of understanding of this in perhaps their children or people that know them, that bodes well. I think that's a possible educational experience that really benefits the future.
Definitely.
So what have you found that's really been one of the better specimens? What species of plants do you really think are making the best foothold in the best root hold in New York homes and apartments?
Well, I'll tell you what's not, and it's the fiddleleaf fig, which is kind of like been like the HGTV, the Instagram famous plant that everyone has to have. And I can't tell you how many clients or people will just reach out to me saying, what's wrong with my fiddleleaf fig? Why is it looking like this? And they're notoriously fickle. Mm-hmm. And the reason why they grew so much in popularity is because you're watching these shows, like you're watching Queer Eye and you're watching Bobby put this fiddleleaf fig in a corner of a basement. And you're like, oh my God, that looks amazing. And like that plant, A, it might be fake. And B, it's probably not staying there because they need such intense care in certain conditions that really work well for it. So that you'll see a lot. People will come and say, oh, I want this. I want that. And for me, a lot of it is a little bit of a taking a step back and re-educating and saying, hey, listen, like, I want you to be set up for success. And if you have the right space for it, then that's fine. We'll go that direction. But in general, like, most people are beginners and they need something that is going to be a little bit easier. And I want them to have a win for their first plant. So one of my favorites is the Strelitzia nicolai, or a bird of paradise plant. Beautiful, big, leafy green leaves. And it just, it dominates a room and is a really nice centerpiece. And that's something where, like, I barely touch that thing. Every like 1 or 2 weeks, maybe I water it. I give it a decent amount of light. It can handle periods of drought and lower light. I love that plant. Another one, which is, looks very exotic, Monstera, which has fenestrations or holes in the leaves, is a fantastic plant that's a little bit more exotic. You see a lot of prints now with the Monstera leaf shape. Mm-hmm. And then if a client wants something that's a little bit, not more challenging, but just something a little more exotic that takes a little bit more care, looking at something like a begonia or something that requires a little bit more humidity or time and attention, seeing a lot of those pop up as well. But I usually try and recommend a good diversity of plants because you don't just want the same few things that everyone else has.
Right.
You said you're not an expert in botany or whatever, but didn't you say that you at some point, like, you're getting some sort of certificate in plants or something?
Exactly.
Not that you can't learn on your own, you know, because I do believe that you're like a great entrepreneur and can just learn on your own whatever you want. But sometimes it helped to have some sort of formal training, you know, to establish yourself as an expert.
And you're right. And I hit the point where I was like, okay, you know, I can continue doing what I'm doing, but as the brand grows and as my business grows, I need to maintain and invest in myself from an educational standpoint to make sure I'm equipped to handle any kind of project. Mm-hmm. for like agriculture background, I've got a lot of that. I'm still learning, but I'm volunteering on farms all over the place.
Okay.
I've got the houseplant stuff, which has been primarily through trial and error and research and talking with different people. And then the outdoor ornamental stuff, like the landscaping work, has been so new and fantastic. And I'm taking classes in sustainable garden design here at the New York Botanical Garden, which okay. is fantastic. Their yeah. adult education program is world renowned. And, huh. you know, part of me investing in that education was to really put the science behind the practice. And there might have been things I was doing and taking care of my plants in a certain way. I didn't necessarily know why I was doing it. And now I'm understanding the why. So
yeah.
for me to go in now and design a space, I'm looking at it differently. I'm looking at landscaping projects differently. I'm able to now do technical drawings and understand soil composition. So it's stuff that I nerd out on, and it's yeah. just going to take what I'm doing to a different level. And honestly, it's good to just have that educational background no matter what.
That's awesome.
Speaking of that, I mean, it is fantastic. So speaking of that process, what does the future look like for you? I mean, where are you trying to grow? Are you trying to completely build up the brand you have? Do you have designs on starting your own sort of urban operation?
It's a good question. You know, I think about this a lot. And, you know, as a self-described plantrepreneur, right, you know, there's a million different directions you can go. And I right now am very focused on a couple things. Number one, yes, the plant consulting business and the coaching is so important to what I'm doing, especially here in New York, because that is what sustains me. I'm making a city that is very gray a little bit greener, and helping people manage this intense lifestyle. That yeah. will always be a core tenet of what I'm doing.
Sure.
But as I go about this journey, I recognize that as much as I love plants and making them look good and growing my own food, like, this is all under the sustainability umbrella.
Yeah.
And to use plants as that stepping stone to show people, like, hey, yes, you can have a plant here. Yes, you can grow a plant here, but like, this is connected to something bigger. And if I can get you to take care of the little plants, I can get you to take care of the big plants, being the planet. And I think that a lot of people don't necessarily make those connections. So one thing that I'm doing now is focusing a lot on building community. So how can I bring together people in these different disciplines to understand that there's a bigger picture here? Because sustainability folks are all over the place, right? They're yeah. on Instagram, they're in the news. You see Greta taking a sailboat across the Atlantic Ocean, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's so much of that. And then there's the plant people who love the plants and love the green, who might not be as connected to that world. So I host every quarter or so a plant potluck party, where I bring together people in plants, ag, sustainability, soil science, sustainable fashion. Any way that you are connected to this world, I want them to kind of just smush together and learn from each other and network, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. I want them to be exposed to something different. And one day I hope to be able to reach a point where, yes, the consulting is driving a lot of what I'm doing, but also being able to speak on these issues and become a role model or thought leader when it comes to sustainability and approaching it from so many sides, I think is only going to prepare me for whatever that future has in store.
That's really awesome.
That's a noble cause, which we support and, of course, are working to ourselves. Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, I think we sort of started with food instead of plants, but that's kind of our idea, is to connect people with, just because food is something people interact with every day, thinking about that in a sustainability context, the environmental yeah. impact of what you're eating and agriculture. And it's
all connected, but I guess I'll throw a question at you. You guys, do y'all have plants at home? I hope so.
Oh, I'll show you right after. I can't turn the laptop now or I'll disconnect our podcast setup, but there's a garden with, I think, 50 plants about 6 feet away from you right now.
Oh.
Yeah, Noah is more into it. He's getting me into it, but he grew up really in a pretty, not rural, but just like...
No, pretty rural.
Pretty rural. Like, his house was in the middle of nature, and he had the same feelings, I think, that you sort of described, where when he came to live in San Francisco, he really missed, even though he does live right next to a park, but he still feels kind of like disconnected from nature, and so he's... really big yeah. into the plant thing.
I had to bring plants inside. I think it's that thing we discussed before, where it's not so much an aesthetic, but it's a life feeling. And When you look at a nice, healthy plant, your silly little monkey brain thinks, oh, I'm actually home. This feels normal. This feels nice. And so growing up, I was pretty much in the forest all the time. I had a yard. I had trees everywhere. My father's a PhD botanist.
Yeah, I was going to say that. So his dad actually is a PhD botanist. Yeah. So
I need to come out there and hang.
Yeah. No, he's in North Carolina. He's in Chapel Hill. You're closer than
closer to the area
than New York. And he actually is from the Bronx. So I don't know how that happened, but I think he grew up with the gray city and wanted to move to green nature in North Carolina. So that's where he did his PhD. And so he landscaped 2 full acres of property over 10 years, put in more than 5 dump trucks full of dirt by hand, and has grown more than 2,000 different plants and trees on that property.
Oh my God.
It was a real education. Yeah. So growing up, I pretty much saw that happen in 2 different houses. And that certainly had a role in how much I care about seeing this done and care about keeping plants to myself and having some connection to the food that I'm eating. We had fruit trees growing up. We had peppers and potatoes and cucumbers growing in a garden. I mean, that's an experience not everyone gets.
I feel like you grew up where it was so easy to grow things outside, and that's amazing and great. But indoor plants or hydroponic farming, I mean, hopefully that would make it more accessible to more people, because, you know, where I grew up in Pittsburgh, right, or the Midwest, it's New York, it's hard to grow plants outside most of the year.
I think one of the main things is we're not, and certainly cities behave the way, but overall, we're not structuring our civilization around sustainable farming in any way, really. Mm-hmm. We sort of plan cities, we plan human developments around the idea that we can just truck our food in from somewhere else. And that is such an alien process to our biology. So it certainly is what happens in a big city like SF or New York and Los Angeles and other places. And so for the past, you know, 50 years or more, maybe 100 years, we've been building cities that aren't really that connected to the farmland that actually makes them run, right? So that's something we think about all the time. And any effort to not undo that, but to make that make more sense with nature, boy, that's the right thing to be doing, isn't it? And that's why you're here.
Hey, you'd think so, but, you know, unfortunately, I think we're obstructed in many ways. You know, having a government that supports these initiatives as well is critical. And I know it's not always the easiest right now. And funny, I was at an ag tech event in New York City, and I met the CIO of the Department of Agriculture under Obama. Fantastic woman. And, you know, everyone's talking about these really amazing innovations in technology and growth and what they're doing with their urban farm.
Yeah.
And someone asked her, they're like, what are you most excited about? She said policy.
Yeah.
And love that answer. And I have a couple friends who feel similarly, because none of this matters if we can't solve the policy issues. And, you know, you look at the stats that kind of like the ticking time bomb of the harvest, that like 60 usable harvests left until we've completely destroyed our soil and our earth. I mean, it's terrifying. And I hate to call them like the flyover states. That's what most people will call them, right? But when you head out into those areas and you see just fields and fields of monocropping, and it's all they've ever known, and the margins are razor thin, and half the food is not even being produced for food, it's being used for ethanol or corn syrup or animal feed. Like, it's a scary reality that I think is changing, but I don't know if it's changing fast enough.
At scale, it's not changing. I mean, so it is changing, because we finally have people telling us, oh, this is actually so wrong and it needs to change. But, and then, so the ideas are out there, and so small operations have begun to push back, certainly. But for the most part, a huge amount of the food is still industrially farmed. And there's even food waste issues that go into how much land is being used. So it's truly not something people think about. So anything that we can do to increase awareness of what's actually happening, people have to be aware that this is a crisis. I'm not using my crisis voice right now, but this is a crisis. I mean, this is not optional. We think it's aesthetic. We think it's about, oh, bringing the food closer to home. It's about having food. It's about having nature available to us. So, you know, not to catastrophize this, but people need to pay attention to the fact that if we don't make those changes, the changes will be made for us in a direction we don't necessarily want.
Yeah. And like, believe me, I love it when I hear thought leaders like Elon Musk saying, like, we're going to Mars, we're doing this. And like, I have a friend on Instagram who's like learning and helping the space stations learn how to grow their own food. And like, that's great. But like, I feel like we're running away as far as we possibly could be from a lot of the problems that we've, I don't know if we've given up, but like, it's not always the most encouraging.
Absolutely. There's a small caveat to that. So you hit on space, of course, one of my own passions, and it's completely correct to say we're running away from problems and we're trying to develop places far beyond what we have right now. The small caveat is a lot of the technologies that we use to develop and deploy humanity into space are essentially by their default nature sustainable, because whatever you do in space must self-sustain or it will not function as a space habitat. So a lot of the construction techniques, the plant growing, all of those actual technologies, methodologies do flow back to Earth and help us innovate in ways never before seen on the planet. At the same time, people don't really recognize that. So
That's a great perspective.
If those innovations don't get, you're welcome. And I hope I can share that more widely. But if people don't recognize that's what's happening, they'll support neither space exploration nor sustainable farming. So it's sort of still the same battle.
That comes up a lot where people are like, we need to focus on this planet before we focus on space. And I really like Noah's perspective on that. I think it's somewhat unique, but maybe like very futuristic.
Space is tough because people think, you know, some people who are both aggressively excited about exploration and not really focused on our planet overall think, okay, once we do that, we're just home free. It's the Wild West out there. And that's true. What they're forgetting is that there's a very tangible possibility that humanity just doesn't achieve that. I mean, you have to make your planet smart enough and sustainable enough to make your species a spacefaring species. So they have to go hand in hand, or what you're doing is becoming just an industrial mining operation at some point. There's plenty of space out there in the universe, but if we don't figure out how to live properly, it's not going to be the best of humanity that goes out there. It's going to be war and mining. which is how we treat underdeveloped nations and spaces on Earth with war and mining operations. So we have to think about it that way. Where what would we do if we went to a new habitat? What would we do if we discovered we could live on the oceans and establish habitats there? Would we just truck in our resources and combat the natives, or would we and combat the native environment as well, or would we attempt to make something that had some sort of cyclical nature to it and could actually replicate? I love this stuff, as you can understand. But I think it goes directly back into thinking about how we live in cities, because we've done this thing where we go in and we build up and we produce what creates an amazing environment for commerce, but it's not necessarily capable of self-replicating, of self-sustaining. That's a problem.
Yeah, couldn't agree more.
Yeah, well, it's just a lot of thoughts. Probably.
It all gets back. I know it all gets back into what we do with our cities, what we do with our food. So, in your own space, do you have a good share of plants now? So you're living in the city. Do you manage to keep yourself green?
Oh yeah, I mean I'm basically part plant at this point. I think that between the 65 plus plants, my girlfriend in the space, an 80-pound chocolate lab named Buster. Like, it's a lot, right? And there's a lot of life in our space, which I love. It makes me feel great. I am trying to, we're moving in May or June and looking to get a bigger space where I can start doing a few more experiments. The grow light technology that's available now is just absolutely fantastic and much cheaper than people realize. And, you know, one of my hacks actually for some of my clients is installing grow lights in normal bulb outlets, or sockets rather. So these are lights that most people think grow light. They say, oh, it's that blue and red that creates that purple glow. Like, I don't want that. Like, I wouldn't want that either. But some of the technology now is full spectrum and is allowing you to put a light that would look like any other light, but it happens to be a grow light and can sustain life wherever that space is. And in New York apartments, which you could have the biggest south-facing window in the world, but if you have another building 2 feet away, it's not happening.
Right.
Like, you have to be creative about how you do that. And for me, I'm using it more so for food production. So what are some certain things that I could grow in a very controlled environment that if I don't have the outdoor space, I can really sort of manifest and cultivate there. I am staying away from things that require pollination. Tried to grow tomatoes in my living room about a year and a half ago. And although they were fantastic, I wasn't diligent enough to hand pollinate and do all that myself. And it just became a hassle. I had 2 9-foot tomato plants with maybe 2 tomatoes across the board, right? So not ideal.
Wow.
But
maybe there's there's a reason people don't do that. But
yeah,
it's good because now you know.
Yeah,
it makes you better. I mean, it makes you better at your job. So
if it was me alone, I would release beneficial insects into the environment. But I think I'd be living on the street at that point. if my girlfriend found out.
Oh my!
So I willingly release bees and other pollinators into the space, but. Integrative pest management, by the way, is just fascinating.
Very
cool stuff, but I don't think it's replicable for a New York City indoor apartment.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of people doing that at Davis. I don't know that much about it.
We're still running the issue of, right, like the apartment is not a farming landscape. It's just, it was never designed for that. It's designed to pack people in. How would you redesign an urban apartment or like an urban living space? How would you ideally set that up for a person to live?
That's a good question. I think that if I were to take a look at New York, and first of all, New York is making great strides. The passing of the Green Roofs Bill last year, which is kicking into effect now, and like the amount of green activity on our underused roof spaces is going to be astounding.
Mm-hmm.
And as much as I love ornamental stuff, making things look great, incorporating native species, like, we need to use those more for food. And I work with a company called Green Food Solutions, which builds these, like, hydroponic towers on the rooftops. And they produce ridiculous amounts of food, and it's such a value add.
Yeah.
You know, if you're living in one of the apartments, you know, you can go up there and have your own CSA just on your roof.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think it has to really be that complex. Like, if you have spaces where a lot of buildings are situated around courtyards, which have trees and grassy areas. Like, that's great, but I haven't seen anyone sitting down in those grassy areas in months, right? So to use those early portions of those for food production is, I think, such a step in the right direction and will expose people to something that, like, hey, like, I didn't even know this was possible. Maybe I have a, you know, 2x4 terrace where I can grow something. I know people will do that on their balconies all the time. So there's a lot untapped potential in the city. I just think that we have to get away from, like, it has to look perfect and aesthetically the way, you know, everything else looks. That's why I don't like front lawn.
You know?
I don't plan on having a front lawn. I plan on having my beds there and all of my crops that are growing in the backyard. They could be growing in the front yard too. So there's a lot of work to be done.
Have you heard of Food Tank or Danielle?
Yes, isn't Danielle a Tufts alum?
Yeah, she went to Friedman. Yeah, the Friedman Nutrition School. Yeah. So that's where I have heard that before. She's like, doesn't like front lawns, you know. She thinks for a more sustainable food system, why are we creating like lawns? Why should we just create plants and put gardens and plants there? So
It's I forget where I heard this from, but one of my friends was talking about sort of the theory of why lawns came into existence. I think it was on a podcast.
Yeah.
But they talked about this pastoral, like, artistic movement.
Yeah.
In Europe, where people were just painting the countryside in these beautiful green spaces, and that kind of got ingrained in our culture. And it reached the point now where, like, everyone has to have their lawn, and it's kind of also become very stereotyped towards men. Like, if you've ever seen, like, Scott's advertising, it's like, hey, do you want a lawn that has weeds in it? Like, use this. And it's just so confusing to me, and it really doesn't make a lot of sense.
Yeah, and I have another thought. I don't know if this is true, but sometimes I feel like stuff with sustainability kind of goes opposed to luxury and wealth. Like, maybe people were having lawns because they were like, I have all of this money. I don't need to grow food. You know, I just want to display this beautiful, beautiful green space.
I completely agree with that. And I think when people hear the word sustainability, which I think is overused and masked over a lot of important issues, they think like you're wearing like hemp everything, you're super granola. Mm-hmm. The vibes from it are not luxurious. And I think that's changing now, especially in New York, where to get some of these big stakeholders who do have money and influence to be able to show that there is a way to do it in a sustainable way that also looks great, I think that's fantastic. And you know, one interesting example of this, but there's a company based out of Brooklyn that is making lampshades and other types of furniture out of mycelium.
Oh, wow.
And it's fascinating, and they look great. And they, granted, I know that, you know, there's probably a certain type of clientele that they have, but the fact that anyone's even exposed to that, I think, is a fantastic step in the right direction.
And just for people that don't know what mycelium is, can you just...
Basically, it's like a fungal network that's living in the soil, and you can actually grow it and cultivate it.
Yeah.
And it's that white substance that you'll often see.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I was actually literally talking to your dad the other day, like part of his like doctoral research was about like fungal mycelium. So I know, but I don't know if everyone else knows what that is.
Botany and microbiology, right? Is this the company that's launched a brand called Reishi or something? That was,
I don't know. I mean, I know there's a couple players in the space, but I'm not familiar.
Yeah, I know they're doing furniture and fashion, and they're doing fungal leather now as well, which is super interesting. Ooh. Yeah. So it's happening on both coasts possibly, which is great to hear. Anything that can be done to use the natural world in a intelligent way, and this, what's more sustainable than this sort of self-replicating material that's meant to be in nature. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
So we mentioned a few minutes ago the Green Roof Act in New York. Does that actually, do you know exactly what that implies? Is that all new buildings have to have green roofs now?
I believe it's all new buildings. I don't know the exact legislation specifics, but I know that they couldn't necessarily do it for all old buildings because structurally speaking, it's not always possible for them to handle certain weights, and some are not even accessible for people for safety reasons. Mm-hmm. I think that it's going to be interesting to see what sort of shape and forms these roofs take. I think most people will stick with ornamental stuff. I'm hoping it's a little bit more food-based. Mm-hmm. The problem is you get into some of these questions about like, okay, like, do I have to use special soil that weighs less because there's a lot of weight up there? What about the watering needs? Who's going to maintain it? So for food purposes, it can get tricky. I will say, though, that there's a brilliant example of a really unique technology in Paris. I visited a rooftop farm there, and excuse me for butchering this with my horrible French accent, but it's called Soulefraise, I think. Soulefraise. But what they've done is they have built this tremendously productive rooftop farm at a few different locations throughout Paris that is not reliant upon traditional in-the-ground agriculture. They basically built these sheets, these growing medium sheets out of, I think it's rock wool and hemp or sheep's wool and hemp. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And they're covered in green, and there's these little, like almost like a nursery pot kind of cups of barely any soil. And there's a drip irrigation at the top that flows through the bottom, and it's recycled all the way through. So it's a combination of hydroponics with this interesting growing medium. And they produce 5 to 7 tons of tomatoes on this rooftop every year. And wow. It's lightweight. And it's something that I think could look really cool in New York. And I'm not sure when they're expanding, but they've done some fantastic work up there. They have beehives as well. And it's just such a unique, futuristic way of looking at bringing green to different roof spaces.
Yeah, I mean, we see this as a necessity, frankly. I mean, there's a law I can see that France is trying to do the same thing as New York and make sure that every roof has solar panels or greenery on it. It should be the norm. We just shouldn't have these underdeveloped spaces that could potentially be life-saving greenery. So We're hopeful that this is going to get more popular, but it's still the fringe. We're still at the periphery here, just starting to make this make sense to people. And we all sort of want to say that it's quite essential. It's a process. Yeah. It's definitely a process.
You said you were moving, right? So are you moving to a place that has a rooftop garden?
Don't know yet. Preferably it has underdeveloped roof space that I can then take over.
Right.
To be determined, but definitely looking in the Brooklyn area where get a little bit more space to maneuver and experiment a little bit.
Sure. Cool. And that's good. This proves that whether it's meant to be or not, people can take pretty much any space they have and do something with it, make it a little bit greener.
Yeah.
Yeah, wherever it is. Is there something that people should look for when they're hunting for a property, either, you know, out in the rural areas or in big cities, that would sort of make it a better choice as far as being able to grow things?
You know, it's funny you mentioned that, because I am a pain in the ass to the real estate agents that I have spoken with, because I'm like, listen, I'm not seeing the space unless you tell me what the exposures are.
Mm-hmm.
And half of them don't know. And it becomes a big whole thing, but you know, anytime you can get, I mean, obviously south facing window is going to be the best for light, especially for some of the plants that I have, and my intent to grow food requires a lot of that. But looking at that, I think is fantastic. Anytime you can get outdoor space, even if it's a tiny balcony, you can still have an herb garden.
Uh-huh.
And it brings so much to your cooking at home. And, you know, if you are lucky enough to have a terrace or a backyard, the world is your oyster at that point. Like, you have so many options, but I don't want people to think that having outdoor space is a requirement.
Right.
Like, there are plenty that you can do. Yes, you may harvest your kale salad, and it's literally enough kale for one salad, but like, it's the best tasting kale salad you will ever have. And it's eye opening. And I want people to realize that, like, just because you said you didn't like kale that you bought at the local grocery store doesn't mean that the one you grow in your home,
mm-hmm.
you won't like that too, because mm-hmm. we don't realize how much of the taste of food that we've lost. And I bet you even our parents' generation, the tomatoes tasted different for them, even the homegrown ones. So there's a lot that we're missing. And I think if we can make sustainability sexy and luxurious and related to fine dining, it's a great step in the right direction. But on top of that, and I'll get off my soapbox here in a minute, but like, I think it's fantastic that we're having this conversation in New York and California.
Mm-hmm.
But this conversation needs to be had in many other places. Mm-hmm. And it can't just be, well, just mm-hmm. change it, just do something different, because that's just going to further polarize the two groups that we basically created here in the country. And you know, I look at a really amazing example, a company called App Harvest. My friend is the CEO, and he is building the largest continuous greenhouse in the U.S. in Pikeville, or not, I think it's outside of Pikeville, Kentucky, but it's in rural Kentucky. And people ask him, like, why Kentucky?
Yeah.
Like, this doesn't make any sense. And he's saying it makes perfect sense for a couple reasons. Number one, Kentucky is within this area within Kentucky is within a 24 hours drive of 68% of the U.S. population.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of reducing food miles, he can get to Chicago, he can get to Austin, he can get to New York, Miami. It's really centrally located. Number two, he is realizing that if we're going to move away from some of the old school fossil fuel energy sources like coal that we've had, we can't just abandon that industry and then say, okay, coal miners, you're on your own.
Yeah.
Like, he's providing jobs and an industry for these people who are basically being told, like, your livelihood and the generations of your family members who made a living doing this, yeah, that's obsolete, that's done. And when you're living in New York, you're like, yeah, get rid of coal, we're done, like, we're moving forward. But we have to support those that are losing out on this, and they haven't known any other way. So I think it's really important to extend this conversation and support groups that are doing it in the untraditional areas where sustainability isn't as widely talked about.
Yeah, That sounds awesome. We'd love to talk to him sometime.
Yeah. Oh man, that's we just Googled that as we are tending to do, and it's absolutely right. I mean, we're seeing now that it's pretty critical that you get everyone on board to have a huge impact. Otherwise, you're basically just changing the places that people already want to change, and this has to help everyone. That's huge. So that's great to hear. We'll throw links to this company as well into the podcast notes after the show.
Cool.
So this has been an absolutely amazing conversation. We've hit on so many subjects, and we'd like to take the opportunity to thank you so much for coming on and sharing your knowledge of plants, of urban farming, of the environment and cities and more with us. Where can folks find you online?
So on Instagram, just Farmer Nick NYC. Website's the same. If you have any plant questions, definitely don't be afraid to reach out. And, you know, I just encourage you all to keep spreading this green message. And even if it starts with buying a plant, whatever that first step is, just do it.
Couldn't agree more. We'll have links in the description. Thank you again.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate it.
No, thank you both.